morning to you all, and welcome to the 9th lecture of the 2017 Palliative Care Lecture Series. Hospice New Zealand would like to thank and acknowledge the Genesis Oncology Trust for their generous support and funding to deliver these free lectures. The lecture today will be recorded, and it will be available on the Hospice New Zealand website. Please be aware there will be an opportunity for questions at the end of the presentation. We would now like to introduce our guest speaker today, Dr. Timothy Sutton. Tim has been a cardiologist at Middlemore Hospital for the last 16 years. During that period, he has been extensively involved in managing patients with advanced heart disease, often during its end stages. Over this time, he has hugely appreciated the growth of the palliative care service and their increasing interaction in helping with the patients with non-cancer-based disease. He appreciates the chance to discuss this further. Welcome, Tim. Please go ahead.
Thanks very much, Ruth. Hi, I'm Tim Sutton. I'm a cardiologist at Middlemore Hospital, and hopefully we've got the first slide up. And as you can see, I'm just going to give my perspective on palliative care as a cardiologist and having been involved in managing patients at different stages of their disease. So thanks for giving me the chance to do this. Can we go to the next slide? What I'll try and cover during the talk, as I know that people listening have kind of varied exposure to heart problems, are the common conditions we treat in day-to-day cardiology practice and what their symptoms are, and then we'll shift towards talking about when the heart's failing, which is mainly where palliative care treatment is involved and what sort of treatments we've got to try and help patients who have a diagnosis of heart failure, how we try and predict disease trajectory and how difficult that can be, and then moving on to end stages, talking about how to try and manage symptoms and what to do about medications that patients may have been on for years and which ones we can try and withdraw. And then we'll spend a bit of time talking about when a patient's got a defibrillator in, what to do with them when people are reaching the end stages of their disease, and then what I think are a few of the challenges with palliative care and the palliative care cardiology interface. Can we go to the next slide, which should be slide 3? So the most common thing we deal with, which we won't talk much about, is ischemic heart disease. So that either causes stable heart artery problems. In other words, when people exercise, they get tight in the chest or they get breathless because there's not enough flow to a heart artery. Sorry. And the main medications that we give there are aspirin. We give statin pills, and statins are to try and prevent problems in the future. And we give medications to try and control angina. And as patients' conditions advance, they may become more symptomatic and be thinking about treatment options, such as putting a stent in or undergoing a bypass surgery. And the main focus of those treatments is to improve patients' sense of well-being. But bypass also has a survival benefit as well. And if we move to the unstable coronary syndromes, which are when people have a heart attack or an acute coronary syndrome, they present with unstable symptoms, so they have symptoms at rest, they may present with heart failure. Once again, the medications are pretty similar for stable heart disease, except often they're on two blood thinners. They'll either be on aspirin and a medicine called ticagrelor or Brilinta, or something called Plavix or clopidogrel, and those are added in to try and help get people through the early stages after a heart attack. And if they have stents put in, it's to try and help to stop the stents clotting off. And we really don't want those stopped for up to at least about 6 months after a stent is put in. And some patients with an acute coronary syndrome will end up having a bypass as well. And what we have to remember, if the heart's failing, one of the commonest causes is ischemic heart disease, especially if people have had a heart attack before and it's caused a scar on the heart. So if we move on to the next slide, that leads into heart failure. And essentially, heart failure is a clinical syndrome. So patients report a group of symptoms and have physical findings on examination that fit with the diagnosis. So they feel breathless. They may get breathless when they're lying flat in bed. They have a sensation of fatigue. They may get bloated or swollen. Often they develop right upper quadrant pain because the liver's congested. They get anorexia and go off their food, and sometimes angina will be a symptom as well. And there's essentially two types of heart failure. One is where the heart doesn't work properly as a pump, which is easy enough to conceptualize. If the heart doesn't squeeze well enough, you don't push enough blood forward, you feel tired, it gets backs up on your lungs and you feel breathless. The other type of heart failure is called heart failure with a preserved ejection fraction. So in other words, the pump squeezes properly, but it doesn't fill properly. And it's sort of like if you imagine the heart's a gun. If you don't prime a gun properly, it won't fire properly. And that's what heart failure with a preserved EF is. And that tends to be more common in older people, especially for hypertensive females. And the medicines we use to try and help people with heart failure are shown on the graph here. You can see there's a whole collection. We use diuretics. We use angiotensin-converting enzyme inhibitors, beta blockers. ARA is aldosterone receptor antagonists, or spironolactone. Sometimes we add in digoxin or nitrates, but the three main drugs that we use that improve survival are the ACE inhibitors, beta blockers, and the ARAs. And that's for patients with an impaired pump. If we look at the ones with a preserved pump, we don't have a lot of medications that actually make a big difference, and treatment is about controlling symptoms, and that's where diuretics and potentially drugs like spironolactone sit. So if we move on to the next slide, and then going beyond medication, some people have special types of pacemakers put in which help improve the efficiency of the heart. We consider whether to put in a defibrillator for patients at high risk of sudden death, and we'll come back to how we choose that later. Or there's the option of cardiac transplantation. Next slide, please. Hopefully we're on to atrial fibrillation now, which should be slide 6. And atrial fibrillation is a chaotic irregularity of the heart rhythm. It must be the most common arrhythmia that we see, both in outpatients and presenting to hospital, and causes a mixture of symptoms from anything from being a chance finding at a routine examination to causing symptoms of heart failure with breathlessness, fatigue, and obviously because it's an erratic heart rhythm, it can cause palpitations. And when we see someone with AF, our main aims of treatment are to control symptoms, and we use similar medications for angina. So generally the target is medications that slow the heart down. And the most important thing we do is try and prevent strokes. So the way we do that, we use something called the CHADS2-VASc score, which is shown on the graph in the middle. And each of those risk factors shown gives you 1 or 2 points. And for age, if you're over 65, you get 1 point. And if you're over 75, you get 2 points. And essentially, you get a score out of 9. And the score out of 9 translates to your annual stroke risk, as shown in the graph on the far side. So if you can see, if your CHADS2-VASc score is 0, your risk of AF-related stroke is less than 1%. What I should say, your risk of a stroke is still 5 times higher than if you don't have AF, but the risk is so low it's not worthwhile taking a blood thinner to try and reduce your risk. And once people get above a CHADS2-VASc score of 2 or more, then we suggest they should be on a blood thinner. And that's something to think about when it comes talking about deprescription. And then there's a more aggressive approach with interventions such as trying to isolate the pulmonary veins, which is where AF comes for, or putting in a pacemaker to control symptoms. So if we move on to slide 7, that leads on to other abnormalities of the heart rhythm. Sometimes the heart goes too slowly and people need a pacemaker, or it can go too fast. And there we've got medications, catheter-based ablations, or putting in a defibrillator. Now, if we move forward to the next slide, slide 8, this shows what's happening with mortality from cardiac disease in New Zealand. As you can see from the slide on the top left, we're going from the post-war period, and the absolute death rate from ischemic heart disease was actually quite high. If you move forward into the 1980s, that's where more effective treatments for heart attacks came into effect. And one of the guys at Green Lane, Harvey White, was pivotal in showing that the clot busters, thrombolysis, improved survival after heart attacks. And that's where the death rate started to drop off, and then people had stents put in as an emergency as well. On top of that, preventative measures have taken off as well. And at a population basis, people are stopping smoking. There's more knowledge about treating high blood pressure, diabetes, high cholesterol. So we're seeing the death rate in the population drop, but as you see from the slide below, as the population gets larger, obviously the death rate is increasing. But the interesting thing is if you look at the other forms of heart disease, post-war it was obviously high, and that's because things like hypertension weren't being treated well. Rheumatic valve disease was endemic. And then as things improved through the 60s and 70s, the absolute death rate dropped, but it's really plateaued over the last 20 to 30 years. And as you'd expect, in the population, the death rate is gradually climbing. So it's something that we deal with in cardiac practice a lot of the time. So if we move forward to the next slide. And I guess the question is, you all know this, but how do we die? Essentially, the last thing that happens is the heart stops. So from a simple cardiologist perspective, what we think, you either die with a normal heart, but you've got another terminal disease. You can die with cardiac disease. In other words, one of the diseases we've talked about, but not specifically from a cardiac cause. And then the patients with their cardiac disease is the primary cause for their death. And that can either happen in two ways. One is the heart suddenly stops. In other words, you have a sudden cardiac death. And we'll talk a little bit how you try and prevent that. But by its nature, it happens quickly. Or there's pump failure, which is a much more slow process, and is where the major interface between cardiological practice and palliative care is. Next slide, please. And you'll all know these about the illness trajectories that you see in diseases. And if we go up to the top one, you have stability. So this is slide 10, hopefully. You've got a stable kind of health pathway. A diagnosis of cancer is made, and then there's a decline in physical well-being and the need for input. And that's where this model suggests palliative care input comes in. And this is analogous to conditions like valve disease. And the graph on the right really looks very similar to the one on the left. And this is survival if you have a narrowed aortic valve or aortic stenosis. And essentially, we try and treat people just when they're at the top of the curve where it's about to fall off. And having a new heart valve put in improves your survival there. And this is what we see with acute conditions that affect the heart. There's a sudden rapid deterioration, and sometimes we can improve things and sometimes we can't. And if we can't, then there's often a rapid decline and it can be fatal. If we look at the model in the middle, the long-term limitations with intermittent serious episodes, that's more analogous to what we see with chronic congestive heart failure. So in other words, the disease is stable in the background and you have periodic relapses that result in a deterioration in your condition, and then usually we can get people better, but often you can't get people quite back to where they were previously. And as time passes, the emissions do start to get more frequent, treatment gets more difficult, and that suggests the disease is advancing and reaching its end stages. And another condition that has a similar pattern to that is atrial fibrillation. So that's where, as I mentioned, the heart goes irregular. And what happens, people will have bursts of atrial fibrillation. They get closer together. And then eventually the heart goes into AF and stays there. That doesn't cause a terminal decline, but it follows a sort of similar disease trajectory. And then finally at the bottom, there's the patient who's got multiple comorbidities, which is what we're confronting more and more. The example given here is, let's say, mostly frailty and dementia, but essentially it's the multifactorial things that we see in hospital on a day-to-day basis and struggle to deal with. Next slide, please. It should be slide 11. And you guys will be familiar with this. This is something that's come out of, picked it out of the heart failure guidelines for palliative care. But when I first started training as a registrar back in 1997, there really weren't very many palliative care physicians around, as you'll be aware. And palliative care, there was something that was engaged at the very end of life, and everything else was focused on before that. And over time, what's happened is there's a recognition there should be a more integrative approach. So a lot of what we do in cardiology is managing chronic disease, and ultimately that is palliative care just on a longer-term basis. It may be over 20 to 30 years. The patients we treat have a disease that we can modify, but we can't specifically cure. So everything we're doing is about trying to control their symptoms and trying to keep them alive, feeling as well for as long as possible before things start to decline. And I'll be talking more about how cardiology interfaces with this model. And what we focus on in cardiology is stage one of the disease, which is the chronic disease management. We've got effective therapies to prolong survival. There's ever-increasing resources in terms of educating patients, so we have great support from heart failure nurse specialists who help explain to patients what's going on. This is a long-term condition, and very rarely are they going to be able to get off their medications. And also, we're well-resourced to keep an eye on people in clinic, make sure they're well, and ensure they get the best health outcomes for as long as possible, and also trying to pick up when things are changing. We get next slide, which should be 13. If we look at the heart failure treatments that are available, because that's really what we're going to be focusing on now, if you went back before the 80s, people were sat in bed, they were fluid restricted, and they were given diuretics or digoxin. And we should just note the first heart transplant was done in South Africa in the 70s. If we move forward to the next slide, in the 80s, newer drugs were becoming available. Vasodilators appeared on the scene, so that's drugs like nitrates, and inotropes became available, so they just make the heart squeeze a bit harder, and people feel a bit better. Next slide, please. So we should be onto the 1990s, and this is where there was a real growth in terms of treatments that were available for patients with heart failures. In the late 80s, early 90s, ACE inhibitors came along, and the graph that's by the 1990 arrow gives you an idea that enalapril, which is an ACE inhibitor, it was the first drug that was shown to reduce mortality. But as you can see here, the important thing with all these slides is the drugs do reduce mortality, but even with the drugs in the ACE inhibitor trial, the mortality at 4 years was 40%, so 10% of people a year were dying from this condition despite being on the best treatments. And that's something that tends to be forgotten with heart failure. It's often as malignant as many of the malignancies that people can get. If we move on to the late 90s, beta blockers became available. They were added in on top of ACE inhibitors, and that's what the Karvilov placebo graph down at the bottom shows. But once again, I just draw you to the fact this is freedom of heart failure, hospitalization, and death. And even with the best treatment, once again, 50% of patients meet an endpoint within 2 years. These were a sick population, but it still shows you that having heart failure is a bad disease to have. And the graph on the far right shows the impact that spironolactone has. And that reduces mortality by 30%. But once again, you can see mortality remains high, even with the best treatments we had available at the time. And if we move forward onto the next slide, which should be 15. Oops. If we go forward to next slide, 16, and this is where people started to understand what were the modes of death came from the information in the trials in the 1990s. And there's two different ways people die, as I said. If you've got a heart that doesn't work properly, over time the pump fails or you'll have a sudden death. But even with that, 20% of people die non-cardiac deaths. And just drawing you to that mode of death in heart failure trial, this was a beta blocker trial, and what it shows you is NYHA functional class 2 is where people are ambulant. They can do most things that they want, just getting a bit breathless going up a hill. And as you can see, the majority of those patients had a sudden cardiac death. So they had a ventricular arrhythmia, so the heart went too fast, or it went too slowly. If you become more symptomatic, so you're moderately symptomatic, then the major way you die is from sudden death. Less people die from HF, which is the pump failing. But if you're in NYHA functional class 4, in other words, you're badly limited, this is where sudden death, which may well be a blessed release, becomes much less common, and people die from the heart failing. So they actually die from the pump failure, which is what the main focus of kind of palliative care and cardiology is. If people have a heart that works properly, because they tend to be 10 years older than the average population with a reduced ejection fraction, they have multiple other comorbidities from which they can die. So there's PEs, there's strokes, renal impairment, lung disease. So they're often multi-morbid. If we move forward to the next slide, in the 2000s to current date really, what's happened has been the evolution of implantable defibrillators, and we'll talk about them a bit more, but they take a well patient who's on optimum treatment and you put in a defibrillator as a backup to stop them having a sudden death. And that was all grew out of the data that I just showed you. There's fancy pacemakers, as I mentioned earlier, that can resynchronize the heart, and they make people feel better. And they also have a survival benefit as well. And then there's other technologies that are available. And the reason I put this slide up on the right that says LVAD is just to look at this graph. So these are patients with NYHA 4 symptoms. So they have bad symptoms. The green line shows how people's survival, and this is absolute mortality if they're on best medical therapy. And you can see if you're in an NYHA functional class 4, 80% of people are dead within 1 year. And by 2 years, virtually everyone is dead. So if you have bad symptoms, it really is a poor prognostic marker. If you move forward to the next slide, which is slide 18, this just gives you an idea over time with adding in all the medications. We've got better at preventing death, but 3% of patients a year with heart failure will still have a sudden death per annum, even despite being on the best treatments we can give them and having an ICD, basically. And the graph on the right just shows that adding in each treatment reduces risk. But once again, you can see, even with the best treatments, there is a risk of dying. And if we move forward onto the next slide and what may lie ahead, I mean, you may have seen on TV, there's an artificial heart that people are working on, there's cell genesis, and there's molecular therapies targeted at trying to reverse what's going on. Now, moving forward to a timeline, as you can see, there's been a lot of effort put into generating treatments to help manage patients with heart failure. If we look at the timeline of palliative care in cardiology, the first guideline I could actually find was from 2009, and that came from the European Society of Cardiology and was published officially. And at the same time, the New Zealand guidelines incorporated a mention for palliative care as well at the first time. And the first American guideline I found came from 2014. So this really is a field that cardiologists are only beginning to, acknowledge and become interested in. Our focus in terms of our training really is on what we can do to keep people alive and prolong life rather than necessarily what we can do when the treatments we are giving have reached their maximum effect and things are deteriorating. So if we move forward on to the next slide. So we're back to the stages of heart disease and go to the next one, which should be 22. Moving to stage 2, which you'll be aware of, this is where patient symptoms are worsening. So in stage 1, we've got ambulant patients who are anything from asymptomatic to moderately symptomatic. They can still function. Hopefully, they can still work. As things advance, they enter the class 3 or class 4. Their breathlessness is beginning to become more limiting. They're having more presentations to hospital. Their quality of life is beginning to deteriorate. And this is the important thing to try and identify so that we don't end up offering inappropriate patients for treatment when their disease is advancing. And their chances of having a sudden death are getting less. And as shown from the MERIT study data, pump failure is becoming more of a problem. And that's the time that personally I try and, if I see someone in clinic and they're getting worse, it's to start talking about an advanced care plan for them and where they think their health is at and where it might be heading. And what gives us, if we go to the next slide, what gives us an idea if someone is deteriorating? So this should be markers of advancing disease. As shown from the graph here, the more symptomatic you are, the higher chance of being hospitalized you have and the higher mortality you have. So worsening symptomatic status is an important predictor of deterioration of disease and increasing mortality. As people have more hospitalizations and they start to get closer together, they last longer, it suggests their disease is advancing, and that's associated with a poorer prognosis as well, as is increasing age, and not surprisingly, worsening renal function. And if we see someone who comes into hospital fluid overloaded, you try and treat it and their renal function gets worse and they stay fluid overloaded, to me that's a very poor prognostic sign. It just means they're not responding to the best treatments you have. Losing weight is a bad sign as well. So heart failure is very catabolic. People burn off a huge amount of energy if they have heart failure, especially with pulmonary hypertension. And if you see someone who's losing weight despite eating as much as they can, once again, it's a bad sign. And that goes hand in hand with developing an anemia, having low albumin. So when you're assessing or monitoring patients, these are important things to look for. A low sodium is another marker that things are deteriorating. And if the patient's blood pressure is low and it's necessitating withdrawal of their life-saving drugs, once again, this does suggest that things are advancing. Move forward to the next slide. So just giving you an idea of a case that is typical of what we see in day-to-day practice in the hospital. So this is someone who I've made up his condition, but essentially he's had rheumatic fever as a child, and he's had a leaky heart valve after that. He had a heart attack when he was 55, so he's had a bypass for that. And because he had a leaky heart valve, he's got a metal heart valve put in. So he's going to be on warfarin. After the operation, he's had another echo, an ultrasound of his heart, and he's got a scar at the bottom of his heart from a heart attack. That's not an uncommon finding. But it is a risk factor for having cardiac arrest, which he has a few years after his bypass. He gets resuscitated quite appropriately, and he has a defibrillator implanted because the main reason we put defibrillators in, if people have a cardiac arrest and survive, they're at high risk of another one, and the defibrillator helps treat that if it does happen and keep people alive. As often happens, he goes into atrial fibrillation when he's 60. Once again, that's not uncommon in people who've had his problems, and we're able to control that. But over time, the efficiency of his heart does get a bit worse, and his other heart valves start to leak. If we go to the next slide, when he turns up to clinic, so he should have the examination findings, his heart rate's controlled, but his blood pressure's a bit low. And it's always important, if you can do a postural drop, to look for it, because if people have a big postural drop, it suggests they're dehydrated and they may be on too many diuretics. But if a patient hasn't got a postural drop, it does suggest their volume status is either overloaded or normal. And he's got signs consistent with significant heart failure. And he looks like he's lost weight, so his face is a bit thin, the muscles across the top of his shoulders are thin, his thighs are a bit thin, yet he remains swollen. And as we mentioned, he's anemic, so that's a bad thing. And the ferritin is low, so he's got iron deficiency. And that's something we can treat, and giving iron to people with heart failure can improve their quality of life. It doesn't improve survival, but if you correct anemia, not with a transfusion, but just giving an iron injection or an iron infusion, it will improve how they feel. Obviously, he's got renal impairment and a low albumin, and I mentioned the importance of those. So if we move to slide 26, he's on a cornucopia of medications, as all these patients are. So he's on warfarin and aspirin because he's got AF and he's got a metal heart valve. The metoprolol is because he's got impaired LV function. The digoxin's for the atrial fibrillation. You've got losartan because he's got heart failure. Bumetanide is a diuretic at a big dose. He's on a statin pill because he's had heart disease. It's a spironolactone. And then he's got gout as well, so he's on allopurinol, metformin for the diabetes, a bit of vitamin D, keep the bones strong, some multivitamins as well, and a bit of omeprazole. So he's on a standard collection of medications, but polypharmacy is clearly an issue for this chap. Sorry, and we go to the next slide, and you know, when someone turns up in clinic like this, or I see them as an inpatient, you know, I think you have to acknowledge, as we said, going back to that earlier slide of the disease markers, this guy's got progressing disease. He's getting more breathless, his albumin's low, his renal function's impaired, he's hypotensive. There's multiple poor markers for this chap. And one of the questions I try and ask people is how they feel things are going. Some people feel they're absolutely fine and don't see that there's a problem. Others will acknowledge that things are deteriorating. And if people don't necessarily report that, you try and guide them along and see if they've got any inkling that things are getting worse. Because if you can get someone to acknowledge that or to realize that, you can start that conversation about where things are heading. And that's important to do. And personally, if possible, as I say, I like to do this as an outpatient. You try and see your patients regularly, you form a relationship with them. And often it's easier to talk to the person you know than meeting someone for the first time and having to have this discussion. But in hospital, that's something that we do have to do. And one of the ways I ask people, you know, where they're at and whether they understand that one day their hearts are going to stop is, you know, say if you were to pass away peacefully, would you be comfortable with this? Have they reached a point where they acknowledge that they're beginning to struggle and, you know, life is reaching its closing point? And the other important thing, do the family know about this? Because often people keep all their information to themselves and don't share it with the family. So this is a stage where getting family support involved is important as well. And another key question is whether people would like to look at stopping some of the pills. This poor chap's on about 12, 13 pills, and not all of them are going to be essential for him and are improving how he feels. Some of them are just there in the background. And if we think about deprescription, I mean, what I've done is create a list of the drugs that we see people on from a cardiac perspective and what we can do. So if someone's on a statin and they're in the advanced stages of any disease, I would stop the statin. I don't think statins add anything in the short term. We give them to try and prevent the risk of heart attacks over years. If you're in the terminal stages of a disease, stopping a statin, you will feel no worse or no better. So it's one drug that can go. If people are on blood thinners, I guess it comes down to why they're on them. If you've had a heart attack before and you don't have a stent in, or you've had a bypass operation a few years ago and you're just on aspirin, aspirin could be stopped. There's not a high risk with stopping the aspirin. If you have a stent in, and it's one of the modern generation stents, generally you don't want to stop the aspirin because there's a risk that the stent will block off. However, if someone is in the last few days of life, it's probably not going to add too much. But we're trying to prevent people experiencing distressing symptoms, and a heart attack certainly can cause discomfort. If we look at the anticoagulants, once again, the question is why you want them. If it's to prevent strokes from AF, use that CHADS2-VASc score that I was talking about earlier. If the CHADS2-VASc score is 2 or 3 or 4, the risk of a stroke is actually relatively low. The chance of it happening are only around 3 or 4% a year. If you're in the last few weeks or months of your life, the blood thinner is not adding too much, especially if you're losing your mobility and becoming more and more dependent. So I think an anticoagulant could be stopped at that point. But if someone has a metal heart valve, it's a bit different. They're probably going to need to keep going with their warfarin right till the very terminal stages, because if you stop the warfarin, there is a risk that the valve can clot off and it can cause strokes. However, if we can predict when people are in the last week or two of life, I think stopping warfarin is perfectly appropriate. Often they're also anticoagulated anyway because there's issues with liver synthetic function. Having multiple blood tests is distressing for all when people reach end stage. And, you know, so it's very upsetting when you go and see a patient in hospital and the phlebotomist has had about five goes at trying to get their blood, their arms are black and blue. It really doesn't add too much to what's going on. And if we move down to the other medications, I mean, spironolactone, the older serum receptor antagonist, as people's disease advance, their renal function gets worse, and they have a higher tendency for the potassium to climb. So that would be the first of the heart failure medications I would stop, along with an ACE inhibitor if people are running into problems with renal dysfunction or low blood pressure. Now, the medications I would favor carrying on for as long as possible are the beta blockers, and that's because of all the drugs, they have the biggest impact on maintaining your symptomatic status. And finally, there's the diuretics. And you try and keep the diuretics going, although the drugs that have no benefit for survival, they decongest people. And the last thing we want is people suffering from congestive symptoms. So you really try and keep the medications that help for heart failure going for as long as possible, would be what I'm saying. But ultimately, if you do have to stop them, that's fine, but try and keep the medications going that keep people feeling well. And if we move on to what to do with a defibrillator. So what does a defibrillator do? Essentially, it just sits there in the background. It's monitoring what's happening with the heart rhythm. And inside the little box that sits under the collarbone, the computer is looking to try and pick up whether the heart's going too slowly, and it can pace the heart like a normal pacemaker, or it tries to identify if the heart is going too fast and maybe going into a potentially fatal rhythm. And it's got two ways of treating that. One is overdrive pacing, which is where the defibrillator will fire off and go faster than the racy heart rhythm, trying to get it back to normal. The other is to shock the heart, and suddenly the patient feels like they've got kicked in the chest, and the heart will go back to normal. Now, if you're alive and well and feeling otherwise well, it's a bit of a surprise if a defibrillator goes off, but you recover and get back to normal. If you've got end-stage disease and you're actually reaching your terminal stages, a defibrillator will keep firing until it's told not to or until its battery is turned off. And that's not a very pleasant situation to constantly see someone having a defibrillator fire. So it's, on to the next slide now, which should be ICD deactivation, talking about it's slide 31. And so the ICDs prolong life by preventing sudden death. They're not a treatment. They don't actually make people feel any better. They give them security, and certainly they prolong life, but people still die with defibrillators in. And the deaths they have may be relating to pump failure, or they may relate to other disease, basically. And the important thing is that no one should actually die with a defibrillator active, because the defibrillator will keep working until the heart actually stops, as I say, or its battery's flat. and every now and then a defibrillator. Mechanics don't work, and that'll be why people pass away. So if we go on to slide 32, and it's important to look at when people are deteriorating, because you have to talk to them about having the defibrillator deprogrammed and switching it up to just a pacemaker. So it provides pacing backup, but nothing else, basically. And when should that be discussed? It's when a patient's quality of life is deteriorating. And those open-ended questions that I was putting to Joe are trying to give an idea about when that is and where a person is in terms of their health, and whether they've reached a point where they're comfortable with the fact that their health is deteriorating and at some point their heart is going to stop. And what we don't want to do is to bring them back to a life that really doesn't have that much quality. And when should that be discussed? It's ideally in the ambulatory setting. Sometimes we have to do it in hospital because people are deteriorating acutely. But if it can be done by someone who knows them, whether it's their general practitioner or a cardiologist in clinic, and it can be their palliative care physician, it's someone who they've engaged with. But it's not essential to involve a cardiologist, especially if it's terminal disease from a cancer. You know, a cardiologist is not going to say, no, 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 you must keep it going. We'd say, oh, whatever you feel is appropriate. So the discussion can be initiated by anyone. And if we go to the next slide, which is slide 33, and when patients have a defibrillator switched off, they're worried that when you switch the defibrillator off, that's it, that everything stops. And that's not the case. Essentially, it's a backup thing. The defibrillator may not have gone off. It may never have gone off. It's just there to try and treat sudden death or prevent sudden death if it occurs. So switching an ICD off, patients don't feel any different. It's more the psychological impact of switching it off because it has been a backup for them. And it's not painful as such. What happens is the guys just put a computer mouse over the defibrillator box and turn the function off and leave everything else as is. And the important thing about it is it's actually a positive step. It can help prevent what is an unpleasant death. And ultimately, that's what we're trying to help patients avoid. And who does this? Well, it's actually done by the ICD technicians. I mean, in Auckland, those are Auckland and Northland, there's the contact numbers there at the bottom. The pacing technologists are happy to do this. You just need to give them a call. There's someone available 24 hours a day to do this if someone's declining. And it can be done as an outpatient in pacing clinic. It's easy to do in hospital. And I think they'll go out and take the devices out into the community as well to deactivate the devices. But they do need documentation. It's been discussed by a clinician with the patient and ideally their family. And one of the things that does arrive is like, well, is this suddenly forced upon a patient at the end? The guys, when they actually put the ICDs in, do explain it's a treatment that's designed to keep them alive. It doesn't alter what's happening with their disease, and it will follow a trajectory where it may get worse. That may be many years before it gets worse, but ultimately they will have a condition from which they will die. And the defibrillator helps prevent sudden death, but they're actually advised when the defibrillator goes in, if other things worsen, it may need to be switched off. So it's a seed that is sown very early on in the process, but often gets put to the background when things worsen. And this is something you guys will all be familiar with, is talking to patients about advanced care planning. And certainly that's something that is obviously important to do when you recognize that disease trajectory is progressing. And, you know, from a cardiologist perspective, as I say, this is ideally done in an outpatient setting. I think it's where, once again, it's with someone who knows the patient, they're familiar with. So our heart failure nurses can do it. And also trying to encourage people to engage with their GPs as well to have these discussions to make sure that it's visible, they've thought about this. And one of the challenges we face is how to make an advanced care plan visible to people. If I discuss it with someone in cardiology clinic, it'll go in a letter, and then the letter gets buried amongst a whole heap of electronic correspondence. It's very difficult sometimes in hospital records to find if this discussion has been had, although there are moves to change that at the moment. And if we go to the next slide, which should be 35, unfortunately, it doesn't predict very well, but it essentially shows that we're not very good, this is in America, at discussing advanced directives with patients. Only about 20% of patients will actually have one at the time they present with heart failure. Once they start to have more regular presentations, then it's discussed more freely. And the interesting thing is the patients who are least likely to have an advanced directive tend to be looked after cardiologists. And that may be because we have such a focus on the earlier stages of disease and aren't necessarily comfortable with acknowledging that the disease is advancing, because that's not really where our training has lied. And if we go to the next slide, slide 36, we're looking at what happens. So patients have gone stage one and stage two. They've reached a point where things are deteriorating and we're not going to get them better. So they're in the terminal care phase. And the really difficult thing from a heart failure viewpoint is that the disease trajectory is not well defined. When someone is in an NYHA functional class four, they are going to die, but they may take a year or 2 years to die. The chances of dying suddenly are relatively small, and usually it's a gradual process. There's the prognostic markers we've talked about, but people just get slowly more tired. They get more breathless. If they're unlucky, they have a lot of trouble with right heart failure, which is more difficult to treat. And dying from heart failure is a draining process, both for the patient, the carers, and also for a clinician looking after someone, because they really do struggle with difficult symptoms and often quite poor quality of life that can be difficult to manage. And if we move forward into the next slide, slide 37, this shows what the New Zealand heart failure guidelines have for us. I mean, breathlessness is often the major symptom with heart failure, and we can give diuretics to try and keep people, keep people as euvolemic as possible, so to control their swelling, and we can give the diuretics orally. Intravenous diuretics do work more effectively, and you can give a bolus if someone's a little bit fluid overloaded. This is where hospital is so easy. We just chart a drug and it's given regularly, or you can give it as a continuous infusion into a vein, but often that's not practical in the community. There's the possibility of giving furosemide subcutaneously, but the problem with that is it's often an ongoing thing. It may be weeks or months before someone's heart actually gives out. So how do you actually maintain that furosemide? For a few days, it may not be a problem, but if someone's reached a point where they've only got a few more days to live, probably it's not going to help them too much. So it's something that's discussed, but it is, in practice, I think, is actually quite difficult to maintain. And who's responsible for looking after it? So you can give opiates for breathlessness. I mean, with heart failure, often people struggle to sleep well at nighttime, partly because of breathlessness or anxiety, and the opiates and benzodiazepines may help there. For pain, we keep the anti-anginals going if they've got angina, but try and avoid anti-inflammatories, because they can interact with some of the medications you give for heart failure and do cause fluid retention, which may make people more breathless. For the anorexia and cachexia, if you can treat the heart failure, that reverses. But if you've reached a point where you're at the terminal stages, it's simple things like trying nutritional supplementation and also just eating small regular meals, because the stomach is often congested with blood, so you can't eat a big meal without feeling full quickly. For fatigue, trying to keep people active is key. With heart failure, one of the mainstays of treatment alongside medication is the exercise programs. Once people do start to slow down, it gets more and more difficult to improve their sense of well-being, and trying to keep people as active as possible, even if it's just standing up from a chair a few times a day, will help maintain muscle strength and sense of well-being. And often, because this is not a rapid process, people get depressed, and providing psychological support is key, along with pharmacotherapy, and SSRIs are the safest drugs in this setting. We go forward to the next slide. Just a quick mention about pericardial effusions, because often they do develop in patients with malignant disease. And the whole thing is, if you have a pericardial effusion, and up to about 30% of pericardial effusions we see at Middlemore are malignant, less than 10% of people survive a year. And that's with treatment of the pericardial effusion. So a pericardial effusion is a bad prognostic sign in malignancy. And the treatments we have for that are draining it, sort of like you drain a pleural effusion, or sometimes you can actually create a hole in the pericardium that drains into the pleural space or the belly, and that can produce symptomatic relief. Moving forward to the next step, and I guess one of the tricky things is, who provides palliative care? You know, as a cardiologist, we look after patients for years, and you sort of get quite protective of them, but it's important to acknowledge when people are transitioning, with increasing availability of the palliative care support, which is fantastic, we can work together. So when we see people are deteriorating, involve palliative care early in the disease trajectory. So when we think things are beginning to worsen, so we can talk to people about what their wishes are for the end of life, so they know that their disease is gradually progressing. And as I say, from a cardiologist's perspective, we aren't dealing with cancer. It's not a malignant disease, but we do deal with conditions that don't have a good survival. And often we tend to forget that, so I'm more focused on and I'm more comfortable with keeping people well rather than transitioning to try and keep them feeling well. And it's looking after their multiple aspects of their health, so it's their physical, psychological, and spiritual well-being, and also their place in the family. So it sits well with the Maori concept of whare tapu whā. And what we're trying to do is not postpone death. We're just trying to ensure that when people do meet death, they meet it on their own terms. And there's multiple people. If we go to the next slide, slide 40, there's multiple people involved. And one of the challenges when there's so many people involved is who should lead it. And hopefully this is something that is going on in the community with support from all these people, and that primary care can be the leaders for the palliative care team with input from everyone else, just to provide support. And if we go to the next slide, slide 41, the last thing we want is something that's just left to find its own way, sort of like the Google self-driving car. And that's something that's been done in Hutt Valley. They've set up a study to kind of generate cardiology palliative care clinics, I think, which is a great concept where there's more time and resource put into being able to look after patients. And the major driver for that is, if you look, there's a phenomenal number of patients who have announced themselves as having end-stage disease and don't receive palliative care input during an inpatient stay. We've got to try and work on increasing that. And does it actually work? Now, cardiology is one of the specialities that have mega trials. I've grown up with trials that contain tens of thousands of people, and you know, we like hard endpoints. And palliative care, that's not an option, but there's been a palliative care trial in heart failure that was published a couple of months ago, and it showed that when a palliative care team is involved, the patient does get better care, their quality of life is better, their psychological well-being is better, and so it's important. They got treated by their cardiologists and heart failure nurses, all by them, alongside a palliative care team with regular input in the home and in a clinic if necessary. So that integration is important to work towards in the future. And if we go to the next slide, but what are the challenges that we face? I mean, the disease trajectories, we know things do get worse, but picking when things are reaching the very end stage is difficult. Often with heart failure, the deterioration, as I've mentioned, maybe over a year or two, you can't say to someone, I know you're going to die in the next week or two. You can get an idea, but people will still prove you wrong, and they'll pop into clinic and say, I'm still here, doc. You told me I was going to die. And you say, well, what's your quality of life? Their quality of life is still not good, but the heart will keep on going. And as I've mentioned, our training as cardiologists is very focused on prolonging life through interventions, being it medication or with stents, bypass surgery. And there's very, very little attention to palliative care in cardiology. And as you can see by the guidelines, the first one only appeared within the last 10 years, but there's been so much research for about 40 years on what we can do to keep people alive. And to give you an idea, I gave a talk to the cardiology trainees, and that's the first time palliative care has ever actually been formally integrated into the cardiology registrar training. There's the patient expectations. The cardiology population often have, they've been in the system for a long time, so they have an expectation we can make them better, we can improve things. And sometimes when we have to transition to the terminal stages, they find that very, very difficult to accept and can be hard to work through. And to work through these things, you obviously need time. And I guess time is the biggest challenge that all of us face, because talking about palliative care discussions, it takes time. You need FaceTime with a patient. You need to sit down in a quiet room. You need their support people there. It certainly takes more than 15 minutes, which is what we get for a follow-up in an outpatient. In hospital, there's often noisy backgrounds. It can be very, very difficult to do. And that's where it's sort of very appreciative of the support of the palliative care teams, is helping us through that journey with the patient and spending time. And when a patient comes to outpatients, we're not set up to help someone who's in a situation that they need palliative care. You know, we have 15 minutes. Their needs are not medical as such. They're more supportive, and trying to access those things is really, really difficult. So moving towards the combined clinic strikes me as a great thing. And if we just go on to the last couple of slides, this was given to a talk about dealing with dying patients from a clinical psychologist. And this is something that, I must say, when I'm seeing a patient who I know is in a situation that's getting worse, I may have seen them two or three times, it's the thought processes that go through your mind. I thought it expressed it quite well. Sorry. But then when I have all these processes, you say, well, it's not about me. I'm here for the patient, trying to look after the patient. But that does lead on to, if we go to the next slide, it's the psychological burden of when your patients are dying. And, I mean, I've got a huge amount of respect for the palliative care physicians because it's what you deal with. You form relationships with people, and they are in the end stages of life. But talking to patients that I know, especially that having that palliative discussion is difficult. It's something you want to try and avoid, but you have to do it both for your sake professionally and for the patient. This is a study that was done in oncologists. It was looking at the impact that death has on an individual. And certainly this would be borne out from my experience. It's where you can identify with a patient. It's much more difficult. And some of my most vivid memories of being with patients while they died are people I really identified with. They were the same age as me. Their kids were the same age as me. We had the same interests. You formed a good working relationship with them. And that is much harder on you than sometimes when you're not quite so close to the patient or whether it's a difficult death. And this all plays on you over time, and this gives you an idea of how these oncologists dealt with it. I mean, there's people who are taking sleeping pills, reading, being mindful, but looking after yourself is important if we go to the next slide. Otherwise, it's trying to avoid burnout, and that's something I guess we all face. I think if you're dealing with a lot of palliative patients, it's a sensation you can experience, especially being a cardiologist where our focus has been on keeping people well. The help from the palliative care team sort of keeps into perspective what we're doing if we're managing a lot of patients in the end stages of their disease. And if we go to the next slide, if you're looking for job opportunities and you're not busy enough, one of the things that is a new technology is not putting people through heart surgery and putting in new aortic valves through the top of their leg, sort of like we put stents into heart arteries. And this is opening up a new treatment for a whole people with comorbidities in their 80s. There's been great enthusiasm for this. However, what's been recognized is that although people, this is what the graph in the bottom right shows, although people live longer, they still die from their comorbidities, and this doesn't necessarily improve their quality of life hugely. So there's been a suggestion that palliative care physicians should actually be involved in the discussion before people go through and have what is a palliative procedure. It'll keep them alive for a bit longer, but may not alter their quality of life too much. So, and this statement here on the left comes from one of the world experts in actually putting in these TAVI or aortic valves. And he's saying, as I say, that palliative care should be involved early on. So if we go to the last slide, and like I say, this is a thought from Isaac Asimov, is that life is pleasant and death is peaceful, and it's the transition that's troublesome, and that's where kind of the input of the palliative care team is really appreciated and important for our patients with heart disease. Thanks very much.